So thank you all for coming. I'm, as Fabian said, new to England, new to Oxford. It's been quite a learning curve. Very delighted to be here. I'd always heard about the Aristotelian Society, and to be asked to give a talk was, you know, very delightful, and to see so many people here. Thank you so much for coming on a cold, wintry London evening. So this paper, as Fabian said, I'm recently thinking about the ethical implications of the no-self view, or you might think of it, you know, the Buddhist view in some sense is very close to Parfit's view, though there are some differences, and we might talk about them. So one of the things that I want to do in this paper, just to give you a little look into it, is in 1989, Christine Korsgaard wrote a paper in Philosophy and Public Affairs responding to Parfit and saying, you know, even if there are no metaphysical persons, she's not worried about the metaphysical point. She's more worried about the practical requirement we have. In order to be an agent, in order to deliberate, we need a self-conception. And so she says, we need to construct persons. So that, you know, that kind of response to Parfit saying he's ignoring the practical requirement of agency came in 1989, and that stuck in my mind when I was, you know, talking about selfless minds, thinking, right, I can do all the epistemology, I can tell you about philosophy of mind, but, you know, are Buddhists not agents? You know, am I robbing them of a very important, because I've got the as radical as you can get version of the no-self view. I would recommend against reading Selfless Minds, just for this reason. It's as radical as you can get with the no-self view, worse than Parfit. So this paper, if you like, is just a way of responding to what I will call Korsgaard's challenge to the Buddhists. If, you know, they really have this radical version of the no-self view, which I think they do, though I'm not going to defend it here, can they be moral agents? Can they deliberate? Can they reason? Can they think about what is to be done? So I start about thinking about the journey of a bodhisattva. One of my very good friends and colleagues said to me, make it dramatic. So Bob, this is for you. So you're at university, you've heard all this hype about mindfulness. There's a summer session in the South Lawn. So you go and sit there and do the mindfulness. It feels really good. It feels really good. And so you think, I'm going to do this again and do this more often. So you go, keep going along to the mindfulness sessions in the South Lawn. Then you get a little more serious about it. You wonder about why it works. So you want to go and listen to one of those Dharma talks, the teachers talking about what the Buddhist teachings are. So you end up, you know, finding a little room in London somewhere where there is actually a Buddhist teacher talking about the Dharma talk. You listen to it. You like the sound of it. You know, it is philosophically very engaging. Interesting thoughts, interesting arguments is what they're coming up with. You get a little more serious. You think, I'm going to visit a monastery. And you see all these happy novices, you know, they're just getting into thinking about becoming Buddhist monks. You visit for a week or so, you do some more meditation, you listen to some more Dharma talks, and there you are in the second slide, taking on to be a novice. Now, in a traditional monastery, being a novice takes about, you know, five to seven years it might take. Fast track in a monastery set up in America or something like that, you could get over it in a year. So life as a novice is hard. You get into the really nitty-gritty of the Buddhist life. You have to do a lot of community service. There is a lot of different, there is a very close relation between the Buddhist monastery, or the Sangha as it's called, and the laity. And so you're digging wells, you're, going on missions, doing weddings, doing being there in the time of death, and you know, comforting people. All those things have to be done by monks. You know, you're not just meditating. It's not just about the fun life that you thought, dharma talks and meditation. It's much more involved than that. And then slowly you have to start taking the vows. You start by taking 5, then 7, and then it goes on. I think as a full-blown monk, you need 217, and I think 29 more if you are a female monastic. So this is daily life. You have to go on the alms round in the morning. You eat once a day. I've got even the timetable for you. It gets harder, you know, as you keep going. Get up at 4 o'clock. 4:30, the meditation starts until 9:30. You just have to keep doing various things. It's a pretty full-on life. You know, it wasn't as it looked to be. All this time, they give you the option of, you know, going back. If you don't want to continue with this, there is always a possibility. But of course, there's all the elements of meditation. So these three are the important things. You observe the vows, you do the meditation, and you know, you listen to the teaching, you read the text, you think about the arguments, you rehearse the arguments. In some Buddhist schools, meditation is thought about in terms of concentration or just staying with the arguments yourself. It is thinking about the arguments, sitting with them so that you can convince yourself. Sometimes you just need to sit with the thought. That's what the Buddhists, you know, that's what some schools clearly say meditation is about. It's not about any other special insight. It's just convincing yourself, going through the steps of the argument and seeing whether you think it's a rational process. Some schools, you know, there is a lot of variety in Buddhism. Anyway, you make it through all the hopes, you get ordained as a monk after this ceremony, ordination ceremony, you lose your hair, you spend more time meditating and doing all the things, you become an advanced practitioner, you go further, you become an expert Buddhist who's now started teaching. This is actually one of my favorite philosophers, Vasubandhu, in the black and white photo. And then you become what is called the perfect Buddha or a Bodhisattva. I don't know if people know, you know, the historical Buddha was one individual who was born in India, but all that a Buddha means is an enlightened being, is a being who has, in one sense of the term, who has deconstructed their sense of self, who no longer thinks of themselves as a being having a continuing being a continuing entity. That's the sense of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva I am interested in. Someone who does not think that they have a sense of self. They have deconstructed their sense. They don't think of themselves as, you know, it's gonna be me tomorrow. It is me who is making, you know, progress on the Buddhist path. That's the, that's one sense, you know, that's one definition of what it is to be an enlightened Buddha or what it is to be a Bodhisattva. A Bodhisattva is someone in the later Buddhist tradition who takes on this extra vow, not just to care about their own enlightenment, but also to help alleviate the suffering of other beings. So there is this additional vow in terms of, you know, in terms of what one has understood and what one has internalized in the Buddhist path. There is no difference between a Buddha and a Bodhisattva. They're both enlightened Buddhas. It's just the Bodhisattva decides not to be liberated, so to say, and I can answer questions, so I don't want to harp too much about that. Not to be liberated, but stay in this world and help others, help to alleviate the suffering of other beings. Okay. Here comes along Christine Korsgaard, and she's very worried about all this talk about a Buddha not having a sense of self. She's going to say that, you know, as I said at the start, even if we accept that there are no selves or person, the practical standpoint requires us to think of ourselves as unified over time. We must conceive of ourselves as being the same person, you know, who came here this evening to listen to something and, you know, was worried about what is she talking about? Must we construct persons? You wanted to learn something, you know, we go on and do degrees, we have our projects. All of those things take time, they stretch over time, and so we need to construct a continuing identity for ourselves. You know, I'm going to be the one who walks away with a degree at the end of so many years. I'm going to be the one who finishes writing this monograph, and so on and so forth. And so Christine says it is necessary to be one continuing person over time in order to carry out or even make a plan of life. Even think about your identity. It's very important if you're going to be an agent. So this is the puzzle about, for the Buddhists. I want to put it as a puzzle and then see if we can offer a solution to the puzzle. So Buddhists argue that it is primarily ignorance about our own identity that is responsible for our suffering. And this ignorance consists not just in having a false belief in a metaphysical self. It's not just, you know, having an ego, though their opponents, the Hindu, thought it was having a soul. You know, that's not the only thing that worries the Buddhists. It's also our sense of self as being unified over time. So, in fact, one of the Buddhist philosophers in the text says, you know, someone who thinks refuting the metaphysical self will extirpate the I senses, like a person who, knowing there are snakes living in the walls of their house, comforts themselves with the thought that there is no elephant inside. You know, it's the sense of self hidden in the walls, hidden somewhere, that is the real target of the Buddhist practice. The Buddhist project of eliminating, or at least reducing, suffering requires deconstructing our identity over time. And if Coast Guard is right, the Buddhist project is in deep trouble. That's the puzzle. A preliminary response to the puzzle, and some people in the literature, some Buddhists in the literature, have offered this response. They say Buddhist novices and monastics in different stages of the practice might think of themselves as continuing persons with a plan of life. As I said, it's only the enlightened Buddha, only the Bodhisattva, who's gotten over or who's gotten rid of the sense of self. Everyone else can have a sense of self. We're just trying to get there. You know, they can behave as if they have a sense of self, even though they don't have a belief in a self. And only the enlightened Buddhas have relinquished their sense of self. So the problem is, the puzzle is only for, you know, a few who get to the ideal. But maybe it's just an ideal we should try for. You know, one of my colleagues said, why worry? You know, maybe no one ever gets there. You know, all the Buddhists have their Buddhist project and they make progress and they're happy. But no one actually gets to the end. I don't think that's just going to be quite right, for the reason that I think that we cannot make sense of what it is to make progress on the Buddhist path if we don't take this seriously. You know, an advanced practitioner, by definition, there is a definition in the tradition of an advanced practitioner has given up a belief in the metaphysical belief in the self. So they're convinced by someone like Parfit, Buddha, Vasubandhu, one of the Buddhist philosophers, that there is no self. And now they have to work on getting rid of their sense of self. That's the definition of becoming an advanced practitioner or stream enterer, as it's sometimes called in the tradition. If someone knows that there is no self, but we have to continue to believe that there is one, they're going to be in a constant state of self-deception. And that's just antithetical to the Buddhist view, because it's not just a matter of doing, you know, what is to be done, observing the vows, doing the meditation, and, you know, doing all that. Very important element of the Buddhist path is, you know, doing the right action with the right kind of understanding, the right kind of knowledge. So if we say that the Buddhists, the advanced practitioners, are going to be self-deceived, I think that's misunderstanding the Buddhist project. I don't think that's the right characterization. So I think we shouldn't say that, you know, unknowingly they harbor a self-conception, even though they're actively pursuing the project of getting rid of a self-conception. I don't think that's the right way to think about it. We won't be able, as I said, to properly characterize what it is to make progress on the Buddhist path and make sense of enlightenment. And even to say that the Buddhas or the Bodhisattvas, those who have taken upon themselves to alleviate suffering or at least reduce suffering in this world, that they're not moral agents. You know, that they're not agents, let alone moral agents. I think that's against the spirit of Buddhism. So I'm not happy with this preliminary response. So I have a big plan for a talk. So there are 5 sections, but I'm going to move through them fairly quickly. So don't get too worried. I won't hold you up for too long. So we'll start with Coast Guard's reasons. We'll look at Schechtman's proposal for what it is to construct an identity for ourselves. Part of the plan here is to, you know, sort of really have a go at the constructionist project of constructing persons. Then I'll give you some Buddhist-inspired reasons for resisting such a construction of self, some responses from other Buddhist philosophers to the puzzle, why I don't think those responses work, and then finally, I will try and tell you what I think would be a theoretically satisfactory response to the puzzle. Okay, so section 1, what are Coast Guard's reasons? There are 3 of them and they're all up here. So first, she says, there is the raw necessity of eliminating conflict amongst your various motives because you have only one body to act with. You've got to work it out what you're going to do at any point in time. And, you know, that's one reason you need to think of yourself as one person because you have only one body to act with. A second reason is most of our projects are going to take time and will very likely carry you some distance into the future. So she says, your present self must identify with something from which you will derive your reasons, but not necessarily with something present. You know, in fact, she goes on to say, when a person is viewed as an agent, no clear content can be given to the idea of a merely present self. We have to think of ourselves as beings who will continue in time, beings who have projects, have a self-conception, whether you think of yourself as a philosopher or a teacher or a mother or a friend, you have to have a self-conception. You have many different self-conceptions. They make many different demands on you and you've got to work it out, but you've always got to think of yourself as a continuing thing. There's no sense to just acting in the present, being in the present, all that mindfulness, you know, shit you heard at university. I shouldn't be using these words, should I? Is that allowed? I don't know. We use it in Australia. You could get away with it in Australia. About, you know, being in the present and, you know, not thinking about the future, being non-judgmental, all that is crap. Really, you know, you have to think of yourself as having an identity. And the third thing she identifies, you know, it's not just one identity. Your identity can change. Your identity can change over time. You might have thought of yourself, you know, as a lover when you were 16 or something, and now that identity is gone. It's more the identity of a philosopher that matters most to you. I don't know. But she says, if we change our own identity, then that's fine. Then identity is preserved. But when I'm changed by other people, external forces, for external reasons, then it's not preserved. So for her, you know, our relationship to our actions, being an agent is essentially an authorial, and, you know, our self-conception is authorial and first person. So these are her reasons. I'm sure you don't like them. I don't like them. And I'm sure there's lots we can say about these. I'm just going to say quickly a few things and then we can come back to have more goes at Coast Guard later. But I'm just going to say one thing about each of these because I don't want to dwell too much. Much of this has been done in the literature, you know, worrying about whether we identify only with reasons, worrying about whether our relationship to our actions is essentially a first personal one or an authorial one. You know, how much autonomy do we have? All these things have been questioned. I'm going to just briefly mention some things and then we'll move on to, you know, looking at Shetman. So are we always conflicted in all situations? No, sometimes there is no conflict. We know exactly what we're going to do. There isn't any need for deliberation. We don't just identify with reasons. There is a whole lot of other things that we identify. Point made by Frankfurt, by Sharon Street, lots and lots of other people. Values, care, ideals, projects, all sorts of things other than just reasons. And do we have the kind of autonomy and insight into our subjective life that Coast Guard's account requires? No, we don't. And again, there's a heap of literature on that, but you know, we, as I said, we can come back with that. What I want to do now is put these concerns aside and move on to Schechtman's proposal of how we might construct an identity for ourselves. So this is what she says. As you know, many of you would know right from, I think, 1996, from her first book up to the present, 2024. She's talking about the narrative conception of self. And I think she's got one of the best proposals on the block for this kind of thing. So this is what she says about self-constitution. We constitute ourselves as persons by forming a narrative self-conception according to which we experience and organize our lives. This conception and its operations are largely implicit and automatic. That's, you know, responding to the kinds of worries that Galen Strawson raised. You know, none of us have written that story or articulate that story all the time. We don't need to have an articulated self-conception. Coast Guard doesn't require it, Schechtman doesn't require it. But to have a narrative self-conception in the relevant sense, it means the experienced past and the anticipated future must condition the character and the significance of present experiences and actions. So it's exactly what Coast Guard is looking for. There's no sense to, you know, being an agent in the present. It's your anticipated future and the experienced past that that give significance to what one does, to present experiences and to actions. So Maria Schechtman's idea is that we literally constitute ourselves by forming a narrative self-conception. Persons, she says, are self-creating. Quite a strong claim. And taking a narrative attitude to an experience or an action is at the heart of what makes that action yours. If it is really flowing from my nature, if it is my action, I have to, you know, should have taken a narrative attitude to it. So 2024, she starts using this metaphor, let me call it that, of strong identification. You know, it's not just identifying with your future and your past or identifying with a certain self-conception, thinking of yourself as a philosopher or an honest person or as a lover or what, whatever you'd like. Strong identification, you know, in a sense, it goes beyond the sort of the thin rationalist picture that Coast Guard has in mind. Strong identification emphasizes a deep experiential and emotional connection to a reconstructed past and a possible imagined future. The notion of reconstructed past and a possible anticipated future, that's bringing in some concerns about the notion of memory and the memory, the use of the memory criterion in personal identity. This is a very thin paper because of, you know, sort of the 7,000 word restriction that the Aristotelian Society has. So I'm sorry, I'm happy to come back and talk about these issues, but, you know, that's what's making her think about strong identification is addressing the kind of worries that come from saying that memory is a bit of reconstruction. It's not all just representing the facts. I mean, one psychologist says, and I really like that quote about this kind of thing, it's only philosophers who are worried about the veridicality of memory. All the, you know, psychologists and neuroscience people have moved on to other concerns. They want to explain why memory is adaptive, useful for learning, and so on and so forth. No one cares about veridicality. It came as a surprise to me. But anyway, so be it. Okay, so in order to address all those people jumping up and down about, you know, memory is not required, she says, she talks about the reconstructed past, and happy to say more about it. So this is what she says: we regularly borrow affect from our past and our futures through forms of remembering, imagining, and counterfactual thinking that involve a particular form of identification with our past and future self. This activity generates what she calls a strong diachronic experience of self, which contributes in important ways to a diachronic personal identity. What does she mean by saying, you know, contributes in important ways to a diachronic personal identity? She does not think that strong identification is necessary. She thinks strong identification is necessary but not sufficient for identity across time, because you'd be, you know, have the same kind of worries that was there with the memory criteria. So here's a dilemma, you know, will seem very familiar to those who looked at the philosophy, the personal identity debate. If, you know, you say, if it says that, you know, in strongly identifying with an that any experience that I seem to strongly identify with is mine, that's implausible. Of course, we don't want to say that. And if you avoid this implausibility by saying that I must seem to strongly identify with it, and it must be something that I experienced that did actually happen, then the criterion is going to be viciously circular. So she says, you know, she admits that strong identification is only partly constitutive of a fully formed criterion of personal identity, but our cognitive, agential, and affective capacities depend on a reasonably accurate sense of natural and social facts. So natural and social facts actually contribute a lot to our criterion of personal identity. Just strong identification, just, you know, identifying with an experience in the past and the future is not going to give me all that I need. So what's this dependent on social and natural facts or practices? This is the kind of agency essential for personhood. To personhood requires an ability to interact effectively with the social and the natural world as we find it. And so this is some of her examples of the kinds of practices that we have to take for granted. In our world, we individuate and re-identify people at the most basic level by individuating and re-identifying human animals. So we've got to grant that there's something like a human animal. Our practices are all built around this. When it comes to bank accounts, passports, baptisms, university degrees conferred, and crimes committed, what is in one's human history is part of who one is, you know, that self-conception. The fact that our practices are built this way is not a mere convention or an accident of history. This is not a mere historical accident. It is rooted in our form of embodiment and presumably runs deep in our evolutionary history. I'm emphasizing this fact about practices because the Buddhists want to question it. You know, the Buddhist is not happy just to accept the practices as they are. The whole idea of Buddhist metaphysics is to suggest that we change our practices very much in the Parfittian spirit. You know, it is got to make some difference to the way we live and the way we interact with each other. If metaphysics, you know, is going, it's not just metaphysical housekeeping, it's going to have some entailments for our practice too. So here I come to reasons for why we must kind of resist resist the kind of construction that Coast Guard is suggesting. We are already on to Section 3. So the first point to make is, can we really construct a practical identity for ourselves without presupposing some metaphysical notion of persons? And then second is, why should we assume that our ordinary human practices are beyond reproach? So regarding the first point, and I think that point has been made by Baker, Lynn Baker, that, you know, narrative self-conceptions cannot stand alone because they presuppose the existence of primitive human persons. You can't just construct a narrative self-conception. You know, the one who's doing the constructing, there is kind of a presupposition there. And Shetman is open about it. You know, she says there are those natural and social facts that we have to accept, just a strong identification. I feel that I am a woman, or I'm a, you know, I don't know, world champion boxer or something. It's not going to make me one, even though I strongly identify with it. There are some natural and social facts that are going to limit me, hold me back. The problem arises, I think, because Shetman wants to offer a realist account of personal identity. I think she wants to give a reductive account, right? Very much a psychological continuity account, but in the Parfittian spirit, but, you know, she's happy to add the narrative stuff to it, but it is really a reductive account. But Coast Guard can say, I'm not interested in giving a realist account. You know, this is too much you're asking for. This problem about circularity might arise for someone who's interested in realism about persons, but I'll just go the fictionalist way and think about narratives as fictions, just like Dennett and Bellarmine did. And some contemporary Buddhist philosophers take on this very seriously. So names you might have heard, Mark Sideritz, Jay Garfield, they make a similar move in the literature and say, you know, everything's fine, Coast Guard, we can make her happy, Buddhists can be agents, all we need is to make the fictionalist move, we just have to behave as if there are persons, as if we are constructing these things. I think it's a bad idea. I gave you a glimpse of why I think it's a bad idea. Here's a further reason. I think the problem is with the notion of identification, or the notion of strong identification, if we use Shetman's criteria. So here's what the Buddha says, the original Buddha, in the original texts, which are called the Nikayas. What is impermanent, suffering of a nature to change, is it suitable to regard as this is mine, I am this, this is myself? No, sir, these texts are in form of dialogue. So the point here is they're asking whether we should think of mental and physical states. Should we identify with mental and physical states because they're impermanent, because they make us suffer, because their very nature is to change over time? Should we identify with any mental or physical states as this is mine, I am this, this is myself, you know, I'm a philosopher, I am a world, I'm a mother, I'm a friend, and so on and so forth. And therefore, monks, I say, so this is the Buddha talking, whatsoever form, feeling, perception, mental fabrications, consciousness, past, present, or future, internal or external, inferior or superior, so on and so forth, this is not mine, I'm not this, this is not my self. And I think part of what the Buddha is pointing to is, if I identify with states, you know, any states, X, Y, and Z, mental and physical states, then that suggests that I am something apart from these. I'm something over and above those states. Any process of identification is going to do that. And the mistake is not that we are identifying with the wrong sort of thing. The mistake, according to the Buddhists, is that we identify at all. So the sentence, I'm scary, says of me, I'm speaking of me, is a category mistake. That's what the Buddha is getting at. Not because the predicate scary is not true of me. You know, it's not because the sentence is false. It's because the term I, that has a false presupposition. That's the worry. It's a category mistake because there's a false presupposition that in the process of identification, we bring in something like, I am such and such. We're falsely presupposing there is a self when there is none. Okay, and the second point, why we should not go down Shetland's way or, you know, constructing persons is, as I said before, it prioritizes practices as they are. It prioritizes, you know, our social and our social practices, our moral practices. So thinking about punishing people for crimes, reactive attitudes, getting angry at people, all of those sorts of things are the things the Buddhist wants us to change. So, you know, it's the Buddhist metaphysics, I think the whole point of Buddhist metaphysics, and this is what I've argued in the book and in other work, is that it entails a major reconsideration of our ordinary, everyday personal related practices and concerns and interpersonal attitudes, such as moral responsibility, praise and blame, compensation, social treatment. All those things have to be rethought. You know, we need to sort of rethink our interpersonal relations, not as transactions, as some people call them, again, psychologists. You know, there is some kind of transactional analysis, which sounds like a very bad word for human relations, interrelations. Buddhists don't want us to think about them as transactions at all. So, you know, I think in some sense my project requires, when I'm thinking about agency, requires a reconceptualization of the very concept of an agent and the very concept of moral responsibility. And that's part of what I'm doing today, thinking about the concept of an agent. Does my concept of an agent require me to have a self-conception, continuing to be that kind of person? Does it require me to identify with something? That's the real question I want to ask and address today. That's, you know, I want to argue it doesn't. The Buddhist wants to argue it doesn't, but maybe, you know, we're not right. Maybe the Buddhist project is doomed. I mean, it's good that the Aristotelian society forces you to put in a draft that they will publish, maybe, because you have to write something new. I mean, this is a paper I've been wanting to write for a very long time. actually got to do it because I was forced to. I can't do something that's already out there and, you know, same harping about the same thing. So anyway, so this is about rethinking the notion of agency. And, you know, this is where I would appreciate most help. I'm very happy to hear that this is wrong. But you'll need to tell me why. Okay. I'm going to move on to some Buddhist responses. So here's a Buddhist response from a philosopher who I have tremendous respect for, Charles Goodman. Done some very good work in his 2009 book. I think it's called The Consequences of Compassion. What a nice title. He's addressing Kosuga directly. You know, the Buddhists are aware of it. They're worried by it. He says, you know, Kosuga's practical standpoint is not the only possible way to live and act. In fact, adopting that standpoint results in confusion and misery. The alternative to the practical standpoint is the enlightened state in which there are no decisions. In this state, there is theoretical cognition or perhaps non-conceptual intuitive insight, which clearly sees how things are. Innate great compassion uniting with this insight spontaneously produces bodily and vocal movements that cause the happiness and relieve the suffering of others. Hang on a minute, I don't get it. I just don't get this kind of response at all. Because it's kind of saying, you know, these words, innate great compassion, non-conceptual intuitive insight. I mean, that's what we philosophers want to make sense of. What is going on here? And, you know, they have nothing is said. So what a whole lot of people in the literature just give up on this thing, says, okay, the enlightened Buddhists don't think They just act. So this slogan, in fact, you know, they don't deliberate. They're giving up on this notion. Everyone else, you know, on the path can act because they're self-deceived, except the enlightened Buddhists who don't think, they just act. They've perfected their skill. They're these, you know, have this great insight. And just every time they open their mouth, it is making people happy. How they, you know, how the hell they can do it, I don't know. So that's the worry. I don't like this response. Because when you look at examples in the literature, and so this is an example of a bodhisattva who's making people happy. I mean, this is an example in the literature, in the Buddhist text. You know, I want those Buddhists to explain that. This bodhisattva, Vimalakirti, is engaged in all sorts of businesses. Yet he had no profit, no interest in profit or possessions. To train living beings, he would appear at crossroads and on street corners. He'd be talking. And to protect them, he participated in government. I mean, surely if you're going to participate in government, you must have some deliberative capacities. Well, we think so. We think. To develop children, he visited schools. He was giving lectures. He was doing what you and I do. To demonstrate the evils of desire, he even entered the brothels. To establish drunkards in correct mindfulness, he entered all cabarets. You know, he's obviously a thinking, deliberating agent, thinking, what am I going to do this evening? Which group am I going to target? And how am I going to convince them? Can't be that a bodhisattva is a mindless automaton. The other thing to note is that the Buddhists use this term that, you know, in these kinds of cases, the bodhisattva is using what they call upaya, which is translated as skillful means, which is, you know, a means that is used to achieve a certain goal. Surely that requires deliberation. And this particular slogan, don't think, just act, has been, you know, kind of talked about in the classical Buddhist literature and in the contemporary literature as well. So there are two, most people, as I said, you know, like the first response, there is no conceptual thought or explicit attention. Buddhas don't act, they have no attitudes and no awareness, except, you know, this Tibetan guy, Tsongkhapa, and more recently, Jay Garfield and Graham Priest have talked about this, that Buddhas, you know, have taken this view. They think that Buddhas are aware of all phenomenon and they constantly act from knowledge and compassion. You know, it's the knowledge part that is important. Won't say something about the stories. I'm out of time. So, but this is what Garfield and Priest say when they say, you know, of course the Buddhas are spontaneous, but their, you know, its spontaneity in skilled action does not suggest that the Buddha is acting without thought or deliberation. Thinking and deliberating, they say, are important activities, not only in their own right, as so much of our life can only proceed well if it is done with a certain amount of deliberation, but also because deliberation and thought are required in order to even to achieve the ability to engage in thoughts, in thoughtless spontaneous activity. Thought is hence not a ladder to be discarded, but rather one to be used when necessary and stored carefully so as to be ready at hand when needed. So the Buddha always has the possibility of making a mistake and rethinking, or, you know, just worrying about what I should do in an occasion and require. Very impressed with, you know, I was very impressed. I was very happy with Garfield and Priest's response until I got to the end of the paper. And again, they say this thing. We think instead that Buddhas are agents and are conscious. Their agency and consciousness is non-dual, non-conceptual. I hate those terms. I can't make sense of them. And spontaneous, that is absolutely skillful. So I got stuck again, you know, wrote to them and said, what do you mean? You know, what's this non-conceptual, non-dual? What's this non-conceptual thought? You know, it doesn't work. Thoughts are meant to be conceptual, you know, that's how we think about them. So, you know, got some kind of hand wavy response. Anyway, I was not happy with it, so I wrote the paper. So I wrote my own response. And this is what I'm going to say. So this is what I'm going to say, not take too long now, is to say that what we want to think about is look at some recent theory of action, and this is, you know, people who are talking about how one acquires a skill and how one becomes an expert at having a certain skill. So think of playing tennis. The Australian Open is happening at the moment. Playing tennis or, you know, any skill that takes a lot of time to acquire and a lot of time to perfect. And similarly, think of, you know, acquiring a moral skill. You know, working over and over again at being good in the Buddhist sense. Being good in the monastery, you're being good in the Buddhist sense over and over again until it becomes kind of second nature. And it's that empirical literature about what it is, you know, to acquire a skill and become an expert that I want to look at. And in this literature, you know, you never lose the ability to deliberate and think. You know, the deliberation and reflection are part and parcel of the practice. They're essential for scrutiny, for self-criticism and correction in the early stages. And, you know, these capacities always lie dormant. They might be dormant, but they're always there, ready to be reactivated by the first misstep. So, and absolutely, I'm happy to grant a skillful Buddha can sometimes act without deliberation, perhaps. It's one of those things he's done before. He knows exactly what to do in this case, like an expert tennis player. But, you know, you never know when you might need to rethink a strategy. So what the contemporary literature is doing, it's questioning this, you know, this sort of a traditional dichotomy between deliberate intentional action on the one hand and spontaneous automatic action on the other. So we've got phrases like this happening, intelligent reflexes, spontaneous intentional action, which sound like, what? You know, but there's enough literature, I think, and there's enough, you know, looking at the psychology and even the neuroscience stuff to talk about hybrid theories of skill. They're becoming very popular in philosophy of action. Here's a list of people who are talking about them. And the idea is that skilled action, or even moral action, I want to say, depends on a continued interaction between cognitive and automatic control. You have both kinds of control, and it appeals to highly integrated views of cognitive architecture. I'm going to skip a few slides. You'll just have to believe me that, you know, there is some of the empirical work there, and I can come back to it. This is a recent paper talking about what it is to learn a motor skill, and this is some what it takes to be an expert. There is reasoning, there is refinement, there is a retrieval, and there is cognitive control required. But the basic point is this: we need to rethink, you know, they're not these two categories, spontaneous automatic action and intentional deliberate action. There is, you know, something in building up an expertise in any area, whatever area, you bring these two together. There are some routines that are automatized, more or less, but there are some that require, and, you know, there's a meshed, is one of the metaphors that is used by Christensen and others, that there is a mesh between these. There's always flow on both sides. Experts, so here's a little bit. Experts often have to perform in complex, difficult conditions and interpretive and regulative functions of cognitive control, deliberation, gain increasing importance as the difficulty increases. New situations are always thrown at you, no matter how expert you are. And so a little more to say about this. You know, I was saying, I started talking about the Buddhist training. Little more to say about that is that at all stages of the training in the monastery, all these three things go together. So there is dharma talks, which is reading texts, rehearsing and discussing the arguments. I'm so sorry. I should stop talking. Very, very quickly. So there's always that. So there is always reasoning, thinking about what one is doing, why one is doing it. There is, you know, thinking about the meditation and the kinds of dispositions one is trying to cultivate, loving kindness, attention, and also there is observing the vows. And here's an idea, you know, so think about, you know, one thing that the Buddhists say, and this is a very ordinary example, is we have to get rid of anger. And something you might do is to cultivate, is to, you know, use meditation, loving kindness meditation. You get into that mode of thinking and be able to, you know, extend loving kindness even towards your enemy, which, you know, is very, very hard, and they do recognize it. But look at what one Buddhist philosopher says, if you're having trouble with the meditation, well, just remind yourself for the argument for your no self. What's the argument for no self? Since states last, these mental and physical states last but a moment's time, those aggregates by which was done that odious act that's made you angry, since those aggregates, those mental and physical states have ceased, so what it is? What is it now that you're angry with? You know, that thing has been and gone that did that horrible thing. Or you could try this other thing, which is again an argument which for, you know, stopping your anger, is when you're angry with him, what is it that you're angry with? Is it the head hairs you're angry with, or the body, or the nails? Or among the five aggregates, that's the mental and physical states, you know, just for when he tries the resolution, so try and break down the person into a bundle of physical and mental states. As soon as you do that, anger finds no foothold. It's like a mustard seed on the point of an owl or a painting in the air. This is what they have to say. Every time, you know, you are having trouble, they remind you of the arguments. And even when you look at the content of the vows, just think about it very carefully. There are vows against accepting money, donated money, or using money. No Buddhist monks. There is also vows against food. What kind of food? How much? When? And also against storing food. Now, storing food is one thing. You know, it's the conception of what am I going to eat tomorrow morning? Whatever I got in the fridge? Us thinking about it in the morning. That's, the Buddhists have a thing against storing food. You know, again, I think that's got to do with not thinking about the future self. Material possessions. You're allowed a single alms bowl. When it breaks, you get another one. You don't have, you know, those shelves full of things you never use and you never know you have them. You know, Buddhists are not allowed except that. Kind and color of robe. How much cloth, you know, how many at a time? Only two, one to wash, one to wear, that's about it. You know, everything is, it's not mindless definition of everything, it's making them think you really got to get rid of this sense of you are going to be here tomorrow. Anyway, so I think the purpose of the vows is, you know, not just to discipline the mind, but also reinforce the metaphysical and the practical teachings, and that's what an expert Buddha that does, and the Buddhist is doing it with an understanding of what one is doing and why one is doing it. And I think one's self-conception is not doing any work in this. It's causally and explanatorily irrelevant. I'm going to end with this quote. So here's a Buddha, you know, sort of the historical Buddha, praising another bodhisattva. So the world-honored one, when the Buddha declares that I excel amongst holy men, I do not say within myself. The bodhisattva does not think I am a holy one of perfective enlightenment, free from passions, if I said this within myself, such am I, then the Buddha would not declare that Subhuti finds happiness abiding in pain, in seclusion, in midst of the forest. So the idea is this, I do not from the first person think of myself as being such and such a person, having these excellences, living at such and such an address in the seclusion in the forest and so on and so forth. You know, I don't do any of these identifications. He's not holy, he's not enlightened, he does not identify, not free from passions. I think the correct thing to say is that the Bodhisattva recognizes he's nobody, he's no one. That's it, I'll end here, thank you.